It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Plenty to cover.
Yes.
And local stuff this week, too.
God, imagine that.
Yeah. In fact, local stuff that was in the national spotlight, like Seattle schools.
Yeah. The Supreme Court of the U.S. heard the cases brought by, or rather against, the Seattle School District and the school district in Louisville, Kentucky this week. Lower courts have upheld the Seattle School District's tiebreaker formula that includes race as a way to determine whether who basically gets to send their kids to, you know, the schools of their choice when there's more people who want to go to a school than can actually go there. And lower courts have all held that, but from the tone of the questioning, particularly from Justice Kennedy, who's generally considered, he's conservative, but he can move on social issues, and he is basically the swing vote on a court that is otherwise deadlocked 4-4 on such issues. Well, his questioning is very hostile, and it seems fairly clear that the Seattle School District is going to lose this battle, and it's not just going to affect school districts here, but all across the country. So, not a good day for the U.S. Supreme Court, and it does point out how ideological the court has become, particularly compared to other lower courts. So you can thank Maria Cantwell for her votes on Samuel Alito and John Roberts and so on and so forth. That acquiescence by the Democrats is going to be coming back to haunt us for about a generation, I think.
All right. And also locally, Reverend Ken Hutcherson.
Yeah, this, you know, Tim Iman was basically hounding the media this week, trying to get attention for his new, somewhat not very interesting initiative, which is, requiring reports on one of his previous initiatives. But at the same time, a much more interesting initiative was filed by Reverend Ken Hutcherson, the pastor at Antioch Bible Church, which is one of the largest, if not the largest, of the East Side evangelical churches. And Hutcherson is best known for his, not to put too fine a point on it, gay bashing. He and other Christian leaders had expressed, when Iman screwed up the initiative last year, or this past year, to try and get a repeal of the gay civil rights bill that the legislature passed and Christine Gregoire signed in January. They were trying to get a repeal of that on the ballot for this year. Iman failed in that, and he failed to get either enough money or enough volunteers or enough signatures to get it on the ballot, basically after he stole it from the Christian leaders who had already said they wanted to do something. Well, after Iman didn't even come particularly close to getting that on the ballot, they had announced they were going to launch a new initiative drive for next year. Well, instead, Hutcherson jumped the gun. He filed an initiative for this year, which would mean that he's going to have to get 225,000 signatures by the end of December. And the state has not even read the text of the initiative or given it a ballot title and a number yet, so which are, you know, necessary steps for circulating petitions for people to sign. So he's clearly not thinking about this year and about December. What he's doing is, if I think anyway, he hasn't announced this, but if he turns around and files the identical initiative in January with no particular harm lost from not coming anywhere close in a 4-week period, at that point the state will have already read the text of the initiative. He saves himself a few days there, and he's got an extra 4 weeks to round up and get organized his anti-fag army. So we are clearly going to see this on the ballot in 2007, and it's clearly going to require much more effort from folks who oppose this sort of discrimination to have it succeed in Washington State. It's going to be a real, real tough battle. Hutcherson is not Iman. He has money, he has followers, and he has the kind of credibility that Iman once had but no longer has.
Well, another Ken is leaving us this week. It's bye-bye to Ken Bounds.
Yes, he's outward bounds. He's out of bounds, whatever you want to say it. Ken Bounds is the controversial head of the Parks Department, who has been in that role since Norm Rice appointed him in 1996. But he's been a close ally of Greg Nichols, and for that reason, he's been somewhat impregnable to date, even though he has oh, let's keep the language clean and say that he has strongly annoyed quite a few neighborhood groups with some of the decisions that he has backed, most of them in an extremely top-down manner with little public input or public input that was very hostile to the plan. He has also had commercial development as an element of a lot of his most controversial plans. A lot of people have seen Nichols as behind that commercialization of the city parks. And it has gotten so bad in terms of complaints to city council that Bounds attracted his own charter amendment this year, Charter Amendment Number 8, which required that parks and a couple of other departments that are now serve at the discretion of the mayor be reappointed by the city council every 4 years after their initial appointment. And the way it took effect was they'd be reappointed in 4 years after the initiative took effect, because it passed relatively easily. So we won't have to wait till 2010 for Ken Bounds to forcibly retire. He's going to retire as of February, and it will be very, very interesting to see both who Nichols nominates to replace him and what kind of accountability city council demands from that person when he or she is goes through the confirmation process. That'll be something to keep a very close eye on. And by the way, a lot of neighborhood groups were partying all week after that announcement, because it really does... he was not expected to retire. I think it really is a tremendous victory for a lot of the neighborhood organizers who've been out there working against many of his policies.
That explains some of those empty cans in some of the parks. Also this week, it appears that there are less options in terms of the viaduct.
Yeah, it actually has not been an option on the table, but it's been one getting a lot of discussion recently, which is the idea of just leaving the viaduct in place. That's, after all, there now, and people are using it just fine, and to simply repair it to make it more, you know, earthquake-proof and all that kind of thing. The state issued a study saying basically that any repairs would last a maximum of 25 years, and it cost about $2.5 billion to do it, as opposed to the new viaduct option, which would last much longer, and the tunnel option, which would last even longer than that. So rebuilding the existing viaduct is off the table. The waterfront boulevard idea is apparently also off the table, because the $2 billion the legislature has pledged to help out with rebuilding SR-99 through downtown Seattle would not apply if you just tear it down and don't replace it with anything. At that point, it can't carry the level of traffic that is necessary to designate 99 as a state route, and the state absolves itself of responsibility. So we're really looking at two options right now, the tunnel option and the option of rebuilding the viaduct. That's what the problem with the state legislature is going to decide when the new session convenes in January. Greg are certainly pushing them to do that, and there's, I think, a lot of widespread impatience with how slowly and poorly the city of Seattle has been trying to make that decision.
All right, and finally, locally, there is a report that the number of homeless are on the rise?
Yeah, out of the King County Medical Examiner, they do these reports every 2 years, and what they report is that in 2005, 94 homeless people died in Seattle, which, if you think of that compared to, oh, say, the Green River Killer, that's roughly double, but it gets no particular attention because, like the Green River Killer, the victims live on the margins of society, and it's their own darn fault, right? That is up from a total of 82 in 2004 and 77 in 2003. So it's very much a problem that is increasing in scope, and also it's a fairly safe bet that one of the reasons those numbers are rising is the total number of homeless in King County is also rising. And it's not just confined to Seattle as it once was. You're seeing it in all parts of the county at this point. So, again, a social problem that is not being served very well so far by the 10-year plan to end homelessness, now in its third year, and not being served very well by social service agencies that tend to be clustered in a handful of places like downtown in the U District, because the homeless in this county are in a lot of different places at this point, as anybody who's tried to get on a freeway on-ramp has experienced all over the county.
All right. Moving on to national, I guess everybody needs to lock their doors and windows because the 109th Congress is out and about.
Yeah, they adjourned for the end of their two-year session last night. So they may be coming to a neighborhood near you. So, you know, be afraid. Be very afraid. On the other hand, they can't do any more legislative damage, which is a good thing. They didn't do that much legislative damage in the last 2 years because, frankly, they didn't work very much in the last 2 years. They met for the fewest number of hours and days of any Congress in session and basically took up the practice of not convening for the work week until midday on Tuesday and then leaving midday or end of day on Thursday. The whole purpose, of course, being long weekends so they can go back to their home districts and fundraise. That being more important than, holding the Bush administration accountable or trying to run the country. A number of things, however, happened in that last week of the legislative session. One of them, interestingly enough, was that Robert Gates was confirmed as Secretary of Defense, which is something the Bush administration had pushed very hard for as something they wanted to see happen during the lame duck session when Republicans were controlling the committees so that Democrats couldn't actually investigate Gates' past, which is very, very questionable on a number of levels in terms of the things that he's worked on as CIA director and deputy director, in terms of his business associations, in terms of his ethics, in terms of lying to Congress in the past, all of these different things, none of which were examined. As it turns out, he didn't have a whole lot to worry about because he was confirmed unanimously by the Democrats in the Senate. There were the two no votes, and they came from Republican hardliners who felt that Gates wasn't being hardline enough, particularly in regards to Iran. Those being Rick Santorum, the loon from Pennsylvania, who was unelected this November 7th, and Jim Bunning of Kentucky. The scary thing about that is that despite all the media coverage, you know, Gates said things that were already, you know, pretty much received wisdom among the American people, i.e., Iraq is going badly, or they were things that George Bush has shown himself unwilling to do, namely reaching out to Syria and Iran, which Bush dismissed out of hand as an option. The Iraq Study Group, which I'll talk about in This Week in Iraq, also recommended that. And, of course, Gates was on that committee. And there was much talk about how Gates was approaching Iraq, but very few people emphasized that he said we'd be in Iraq for a long, long time, which is exactly what Bush has been saying and pretty much what the Iraq Study Group said also, although, again, that didn't get much attention either. So between that and his rather worrisome past, it's kind of astonishing that he was unanimously approved by Democrats.
Yeah, and I think a real indicator for those people who think there's going to be dramatic change when the Democrats take over, you know, that it still looks like business as usual, as well as from groups like, I mean, I anticipated, you know, getting that email from Move On, you know, urge your elected officials to oppose Gates.
Yeah, and never happened.
No mention from any group. So DNC supporting groups didn't say a thing.
Even people for the American Way didn't chime in on that one. So I was pretty surprised by that also. And although, you know, in terms of what the Democrats did when they voted, I wasn't at all surprised by that. I don't think we're going to run out of a lot of material on this program when Congress reconvenes in January.
No, I think we'll be busy. All right. Well, moving along, there was something that did come out of that Congress right near the end with Cynthia McKinney.
Yes. Cynthia McKinney was unelected also actually, it wasn't even on November 7th. It was in the primary, I believe. She is not going to be in the 110th Congress, put it that way. So as her parting gift to Washington, D.C., she filed a bill at the end of the day yesterday calling for the impeachment of George Bush. Now, obviously, since the Congress is adjourning, the bill is going nowhere. It was strictly symbolic, but it was an awfully nice symbol, particularly since nobody else so far in either party has had the guts to introduce such a bill. So, thank you, Cynthia, and you will be missed.
All right. Well, and someone that will also be missed, or maybe not, is Mr. Bolton, John Bolton.
Yes, John Bolton, UN ambassador, appointed by a recess appointment by George Bush to become the UN ambassador when the Senate, dominated by Republicans, wouldn't even confirm him. And it had become very clear over the past couple of months that that recess appointment, which had to be confirmed by January, wasn't going to confirm him either. They couldn't get the they couldn't get the necessary number of people in the Senate to confirm him when it was under Republican rule. They certainly weren't going to do it once Democrats took power. In fact, I think Joe Biden is the person who had control over that nomination, and he said that it was a non-starter as far as he was concerned, so it wouldn't even get out of his committee. So Bolton did the graceful thing, oddly enough, and resigned his position. And now apparently that preempted a move by Bush, who is actively exploring ways to keep Bolton as ambassador by renaming the job, if you can believe that. So, you know, he would be a special assistant to the ambassador's office or something, but would still be running things. But Bolton, to his credit, wasn't having any part of that kind of a charade, when the ethics and civility of John Bolton are undermining the position of the President of the United States, that doesn't say very much for the President of the United States. And again, there was talk that Bush was considering George Mitchell, the former Democratic senator from Maine who brokered the Northern Ireland Peace Accord, that he would be a potential replacement for Bolton. But Bush is not especially known as reaching out in a bipartisan manner, number one. And number two, going back again to the spine of the Democrats, much of their concern over Bolton was not over his actual actions, but over his style, that he was abrasive, that he wasn't good in a diplomatic role, et cetera, et cetera. So it may well also wind up that Bush will nominate somebody who is just as much of a hardliner, but does it more gracefully. And that is very much something to watch out for when Congress reconvenes in January.
All right. Well, a committee that you would think would be busy all the time, but we actually don't hear much about, the House Ethics Committee.
Yeah, under Doc Hastings, a representative from Eastern Washington, Tri-Cities area, has been chair of that committee for the last, I don't know how many years, certainly at least the last couple, I think longer than that. And under his leadership, no, it was a couple of years, because Tom DeLay put him in after the previous chair tried holding Republicans accountable for their crimes, and DeLay didn't want any part of that for obvious reasons, like he was committing crimes. Hastings sat on all these different complaints of corruption and actual criminal cases that came up against some Republicans. You had Duke Cunningham and Bob Nye of Ohio and, you know, other people who were forced out of office because of their crimes but never had to answer to the House Ethics Committee. Well, finally, somebody has had to. That person is Dennis Hastert, who was brought before the panel because of his role in covering up the Mark Foley scandal. You always look for the news dump on Friday afternoons in Washington, D.C. these days, of things that they just hope the public and the media cycles won't notice. And one of them was that the Ethics Committee came out with a scathing report about Hastert and his role in covering up Foley's predations of congressional pages for basically a decade. And however, it declined to take any actual action against Hastert, and that will be actually Hastings' last abomination as chair of the Ethics Committee, at least we hope for any time soon, because he'll be in the minority party come January, so somebody new will be in charge of it, and one would think will have a very, very full plate.
All right. The Environmental Protection Agency sounds like it's doing a little cleaning.
Yeah, but not much environmental protecting. Report came out this week from the Public Employees for Responsibility, which, if anybody's interested, they are an outstanding group, that the EPA has been cleansing its websites of reports found in its own libraries, which it is also trying to shutter. The libraries, I mean. And we're talking about thousands of different reports that are basically scientific reports on, protecting the environment. Another interesting thing about this was that in closing particular library in Chicago, they tried to take steps to make sure that the library could not open back up, and that included auctioning off $40,000 worth of library equipment, things like bookcases and microfiches and so forth, for a total of $350. Your government in action. Meanwhile, there was also a report this week that the EPA is actively considering wiping out the Clean Air Act standards for trying to reduce lead pollution. In other words, they would take away lead being in the category of six pollutants that are now have to be monitored by law for the EPA, so that you could have lead in your gasoline again, you could have lead batteries, oil refineries and coal smelters wouldn't have to worry about pouring lead into the air. And as you might expect, some of these manufacturers have been lobbying the Bush administration very heavily and putting money in certain campaign coffers. And coffers being the operative term here. A very, very nasty possibility coming up from the EPA, which has really been both anti-science and anti-environment for the last 6 years, and especially under the stewardship of Stephen Johnson, their current head. So very, very bad news.
All right, another report this week out by the Justice Department.
Yeah, the Justice Department has found that 7 million people are now in the justice system in the United States. This is a census they do from time to time, but don't publicize very much. 2.2 million people are now imprisoned in the United States. That number, if you take it out per capita, is 10 times the number of people who are imprisoned in the European Union. So when we lecture people on democracy and human rights, we don't quite have enough standing to back that up, particularly when you consider that the torture that has been described at Guantanamo and the various other places in the CIA gulag and in Iraq and Afghanistan, many of those same techniques have been used for years in federal control units and state control units here in the U.S.
All right, and finally, nationally, sleaze of the week.
Sleaze of the week, there are three of them this week, and you thought Congress was adjourning. Well, no. We don't have to depend on Congress for this. First of all, we had a government accountability office report that the government is still squandering tens of millions of dollars in what it referred to as wasted disaster aid. This in regard to Katrina, and $17 million in bogus rental payments to people who had already reclaimed. Free trailers and apartments. FEMA has also recovered only less than 1% of the $1 billion that it has wasted on fraudulent assistance. So not very, very flattering there. We also had report this week. The Republicans have paid $135,000 to settle a civil lawsuit resulting from the New Hampshire phone jamming that took place in the 2002 Senate race. That was a very close Senate race that the Republicans won. One of the ways that they won it is that they jammed both Democratic and impartial nonprofit group phones on the day of the election to try and stop get out the vote efforts, because getting out the vote efforts tend to benefit Democrats more than Republicans, all other things being equal. That same incident saw, among other people, the New England head of election efforts for the Republican Party, who is now appealing his sentence. A couple other people have spent time in jail for the operation. There were a number of unexplained phone calls between that New England guy and the Situation Room at the White House, which is Karl Rove's operation. And oddly enough, we saw some of the techniques being used on November 7th this year. So go figure. Maybe in another 4 years, they'll have to be paying out for what happened this year too.
All right. Is that it on that?
There was one other sleaze of the week that Loretta Doan, the General Services Administration head, the GAA, wants to limit the Inspector General of the GSA's ability to, audit billions of dollars a year worth of government contracts, because it's too intimidating to contractors to have to work for the GAO and actually, have their operations overseen. Heaven forbid for that. And that includes, by the way, the Pentagon and all those contracts in Iraq that have been so horrible over the past 4 years.
All right, moving on to international Iraq.
Yeah, a number of things this week, which we're probably not going to have time to get to all of them in detail. No real surprises in the Iraq Study Group reports. It was all pretty much as leaked in advance. One of the main things that was notable about the media coverage is how much it de-emphasized the fact that what the ISG recommended is already pretty much what George Bush is doing. He's talked about wanting to draw down troops in different ways, depending on how close to the elections it were, but he certainly talked about it. The one thing that he rejected out of hand, as I mentioned before, was reaching out to Iran and Syria to try and avoid a regional conflagration. But again, the ISG predicated its assumptions on the idea that we will be in Iraq, we will be protecting permanent bases, and we will, even if we draw down some of the troops, we will not draw down most of them. And it did not touch the issue that was addressed in a Pentagon report this week. That there are well over 100,000 private contractors now in Iraq. That does not include subcontractors. If you throw those in, there are probably more private contractors and subcontractors in Iraq right now, both U.S. nationals and foreign nationals being hired by some of these folks, than there are actually U.S. soldiers in Iraq. Now, some 750 of them have died over the past 4 years, and by comparison, the previous Pentagon estimate was 25,000, and the number of such contractors in the first Gulf War was only about 10,000. So it's very much been a case of privatizing the army in Iraq. We had Rumsfeld memo coming out that 2 days before he was resigned from his post, that he had acknowledged that Iraq was not going well, and less emphasis was placed on what he said he should be done to make that better. Namely, he wanted to change the public framing. He was all concerned about the PR spin rather than actually changing the policy, and that's been pretty consistent with what Bush himself did after the election, when he talked about not using Stay the Course anymore, even though he's actually pretty much followed that. We had Prime Minister Maliki wanting a regional conference on peace in Iraq, but he has no real power to get it because nobody in Iraq pays him the least bit of attention, and he has no credibility there. We have at least 5 Marines that are expected to be charged in the November 5th Haditha massacre of up to 24 Iraqis, mostly women and children, which raises the interesting question of why it took so long to press those charges, since their identities have been known for nearly a year. And we have also the Electronic Iraq Report, this is a very good website, by the way, that there's been a sharp decline in women's rights in post-2003 Iraq, and that Electronic Iraq Report goes into quite a bit of detail about that. It's every bit as discouraging as what has happened to women in Afghanistan over the last 5 years.
All right, and briefly, Afghanistan.
Yeah, the Pentagon and State Department issued joint report saying that American-trained police force units in Afghanistan are largely incapable of even basic law enforcement actions, while they're incredibly corrupt and yada yada yada. The training program nobody can figure out how many people are actually on active duty. There's just basically no accountability, and it reads strikingly like the criticisms that have been made about the training of Iraqi police and army units. It's very, very similar, which, again, is pretty discouraging.
Mm. Unfortunately, we're pretty much out of time. Any events you'd like to...
Yeah, there's one tomorrow that might be kind of interesting in recognition of Human Rights Day, which is tomorrow. There will be a funeral for human rights that's happening at Washington State Trade and Convention Center, and then folks are going to march to that's at 1 o'clock tomorrow, and then at 2 o'clock they'll have marched to Westlake Park, and they'll probably do the same thing all over again, and just, you know, have a funeral for what this country has done regarding human rights.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish, co-editor of Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State is a volunteer publication that comes out every couple of weeks. We are, in fact, in the middle of a fund drive, so we could really, really use your support because almost all of the money raised goes into actually printing the paper and getting word out on issues like this to folks all across Seattle who, you know, look at the name and look at the funnies on the cover and get sucked into thinking this might be something they enjoy. It's such a feel good half hour. I can't get over it. But it is valuable stuff. We do it as a labor of love for the community. And you can find Eat the State wherever you find free newspapers around town, bookstores, cafes, King County Library System, or you can find it online, all of our back issues too. And for example, for PayPal, for making donations to Eat the State if you don't want to stick it in an envelope. That website is www.eatthestate.org. If you have feedback, comments, tips, you'd like to volunteer, we can always use distributors and writers and proofreaders and almost everything else that's used to put out a paper. You can give us a call. Our voicemail is area code 206-719-6947.